Okay, I think this is my fourth visit to Perimeter, so it's very good to be back, and thanks for the opportunity to give a talk here and stuff I've been working on recently. The title of the talk here is a question, and it's a general rule of thumb that whenever an article has a title which is a question, the question is not answered in the text. But here I hope to actually answer this question today. So here's an outline of what I hope to cover. The first few transparencies are a completely elementary introduction to black hole thermodynamics, so the experts can all go to sleep. I just thought there might be some people here who are not, some young people or maybe people who are not familiar with black hole thermodynamics that might be useful. And then I'll go on to discuss the notion of pressure and enthalpy in black hole thermodynamics. And that raises the question of what the volume of a black hole might be, and I'll hopefully answer that question. And then go on to discuss the equation of state and some critical behavior. Okay, so we can exemplify this, black hole thermodynamics in its simplest form just by looking at the Schwarzschild metric. So we take the usual Schwarzschild line element. As usual, as when this function capital delta vanishes, we have event horizon. So that's in units with C is equal to 1, that's at 2gm for the Schwarzschild black hole. And it's the event horizon is spherical, so the area is just 4 pi rh squared. And in the early days of black hole thermodynamics, Bekenstein was led to suggest that there should be an entropy associated with the area of the black hole. That if you measure the area in units of the Planck length squared, then that's a dimensionless number, which is Bekenstein identified with the entropy. But he only knew it was proportional. He only suggested it was proportional to the area. He didn't know the constant of proportionality. Then a couple of years later, Hawking managed to show that there's a temperature associated with the black hole. I won't go into the details of the calculation, but at the end of the day, the temperature is the surface gravity of the black hole divided by 2 pi. And I've kept h bar there explicitly to show you that the Hawking temperature is a quantum phenomenon. As h bar goes to 0, the temperature vanishes. Now, for a Schwarzschild black hole, the surface gravity is just acceleration due to gravity at the event horizon relative to an observer at infinity. And for a Schwarzschild black hole, surface gravity is 1 over 4gm. This is one of these formulas that if you just completely ignored relativity and did a naive Newtonian calculation, this is the answer you would get. This is acceleration due to gravity from a point mass sitting at the origin, a distance rh away from the point mass. This is actually the Newtonian acceleration, which of course is the wrong way to calculate it, but it gives you the right answer. A full relativistic calculation gives you the surface gravity is 1 over 4gm. So the temperature is inversely proportional to the mass. And if you apply this to a real astrophysical black hole, of course, it's completely negligible. The temperature turns out to be tens of nanokelvin. So even in the microwave background, a solar mass black hole would be absorbing radiation rather than emitting it. And the entropy, it just turns out to be this colossal number, 10 to the 78. And remember, if you want to think of this entropy as associated with microscopic degrees of freedom, the entropy is the logarithm of the number of microstates. And this is absolutely colossal. And of course, nobody really understands what the microscopic degrees of freedom are, but presumably they've got something to do with quantum gravity. But anyway, for solar mass black holes, this thermodynamics is really not relevant. But it leads it to interesting conceptual issues concerning thermodynamics. The internal energy of a thermodynamic system should properly be considered as a function of the entropy. The entropy is an extensive variable, and the internal energy is extensive. And the temperature is a derivative of the internal energy with respect to entropy. So if we identify the internal energy with the mass, which is a natural thing to do, then we get the first law that dm is tds. So if we write Bekenstein's formula with little a as being an undetermined constant and just apply this to a Schwarzschild black hole, and the area 16 pi gm squared, then ds is this 32 pi a in the denominator. And when you work out TDS, the only way that can be equal to DM is if little a is a quarter. So this is the famous Bekenstein-Hawking entropy formula, that the entropy is a quarter of the area of the event horizon in units of the Planck mass squared, Planck length squared.
Well, the natural thermodynamic function, which is a function of temperature, is the Helmholtz free energy.
And that's the Legendre transform of the entropy, of the internal energy, excuse me. So and we want to, normally in thermodynamics, on statistical mechanics, if you want to identify, to relate the thermodynamic functions to microscopic degrees of freedom, you do it through what's called the bridge equation, F is minus T log Z. And in this context, for example, if you have a Schwarzschild metric, the simple case again, then you can define a heat capacity, which is, I'll say more about log Z later. I have it here, sorry. If you calculate the Euclidean action for the Schwarzschild solution, then Z is the exponential of minus the Euclidean action. And of course, there's a heat capacity, this famous negative heat capacity, the rate of change of the internal energy with respect to temperature, but of course, internal energy is really a function of entropy, so you have to use the chain rule, you write it in terms of the free energy. And for the Schwarzschild black hole, we get that the heat capacity is minus twice the entropy. So this is the famous negative heat capacity. It says that a black hole in empty space is unstable. And you can do a back-of-the-envelope calculation to try and determine how long it would last. The power will be roughly Stefan Boltzmann law, fourth power of the temperature multiplied by the area. And you put in the Schwarzschild black hole parameters, and you can assume the lifetime is of the order of the mass divided by the power. And for a solar mass black hole, you get some colossal multiple of the age of the universe. 10 to the 88 years or something you get for a solar mass black hole. For a black hole with a mass of something like 10 to the 12 kilograms, people say that's a small mountain or a big hill, perhaps, you get something with the lifetime of the order of the age of the universe. But this raises the question, as a black hole radiates, and it's intuitively quite clear why the heat capacity is negative. The temperature is inversely proportional to the mass. So if you put the black hole in in zero temperature, it's going to radiate. As it radiates, it loses energy. The mass goes down. The temperature goes up. So it's positive feedback. You get a runaway effect. But if the black hole is going to lose energy, either so the mass goes down, then you think the black hole is shrinking. So this raises the question, is this heat capacity at constant volume? Well, it can't be, the black hole is going to be shrinking. Is it heat capacity at constant pressure? What is it? Which is it, or is it something new? Well, if you ask any undergraduate what the first law of thermodynamics is, they tell you it's this. So this is the title of the seminar. Where is the PdV term in the first law of black hole thermodynamics? It's not usually considered. But if you ask yourself this question, there's an obvious answer for the pressure. If you include a cosmological constant, then that's giving you a pressure. So let's identify that with a thermodynamic pressure. The notion of considering the cosmological constant as being a thermodynamic variable actually goes back a long way. It was originally considered, I think, by Henno and Teitelbaum in the early 80s. But they didn't actually think of lambda as a pressure. I don't think they interpreted it that way. But if you do interpret it that way, then the thermal energy, you should include the energy of the cosmological constant in your thermal energy. So if epsilon is the energy of the cosmological constant, which is minus the pressure, then the thermal energy is not just the mass, but it's mass plus the energy density times the volume. And for a cosmological constant, the energy density is minus the pressure. So we get that the internal energy is m minus PV, or alternatively, the mass is the thermal energy plus PV. And the thermal energy plus PV is the enthalpy, beloved of chemists. And I got interested in this stuff through this paper. Actually, I was visiting Perimeter 3 years ago, and Jenny Schraschen gave a seminar, and she put forward this proposal that you should interpret the mass of a black hole as being not the internal energy, but as being the enthalpy. And this changes the way you look at the thermodynamics. So let's introduce the cosmological constant. This is Schwarzschild anti de Sitter metric in Schwarzschild coordinates.
If the cosmological constant is positive, so you have a black hole in De Sitter space, you have two event horizons. There's a cosmological event horizon and the black hole event horizon. They could have different temperatures, so the system's not in thermal equilibrium, and it's hard to make sense of the thermodynamics of De Sitter space. There are problems, which I shall avoid just by focusing for conceptual issues. I'll focus on negative lambda, because then the pressure is positive. There's only one exterior event horizon. And if we identify, we can relate the mass to the Schwarzschild radius and the cosmological constant just by putting this function capital delta here to zero. But of course, RH, the Schwarzschild radius, is trivially related to the entropy, and lambda, the cosmological constant, is trivially related to the pressure. So if we identify the mass with the enthalpy, we get this formula for the enthalpy. In thermodynamics, the enthalpy is naturally a function of entropy and pressure. And then we can use the usual thermodynamic relations to work out the temperature. We get the standard Hawking result. This is trivial, actually, because this is just, I'm just doing the you can get the temperature by differentiating delta and evaluating this function delta at the event horizon. And this is exactly what I'm doing here. So this is just the usual procedure written in different variables. But what's the volume? Well, there's an obvious, when you look at it this way, there's an obvious definition of the thermodynamic volume. It's the derivative of the enthalpy with respect to pressure. You work this out for a black hole in asymptotically ADS space, and you get the answer, 4 pi RH cubed over 3. And at first sight, this looks pretty trivial, but I actually think this is an amazing formula. I don't understand where it comes from. Dimensionally, the volume has to be proportional to RH cubed. It's got to be a length cubed. But why the 4 pi over 3? It's not easy to define the volume of a black hole. If you just say that you're going to take spheres of radius 4 pi r and integrate them out from 0 to the event horizon, obviously you get this value. But inside the event horizon, the radial coordinate is a time coordinate. It's not a space coordinate. So this is like a time cubed. If you think of it as being a geometric volume that you're obtaining by integrating out from 0 to RH, this makes no sense as a geometric volume. This is 4 pi r cubed over 3 is fine for a sphere in flat Euclidean space. It makes no sense as a geometric volume for a black hole. So I like to call this a thermodynamic volume rather than geometric volume. It's a suggestion that maybe one should think of this as a volume in black hole thermodynamics. The Legendre transform of the enthalpy is the Gibbs free energy, which is a function of temperature and pressure. And now we identify this with minus T log Z, where Z is the exponential of minus the Euclidean action. So the Euclidean action is related, the suggestion here is that the Euclidean action is related to the Gibbs free energy rather than the Helmholtz free energy. And when you adopt this interpretation, there's nothing inconsistent. Everything seems to work. You can calculate the heat capacity. And in terms of the pressure and the entropy, this is what you get. It diverges, obviously, when the denominator here is zero. And that corresponds to sending minus lambda times RH squared to 1. But as long as the magnitude of the cosmological constant is large enough, it stabilizes the black hole and there's a minimal temperature. And this was known to, first pointed out by Hawking and Page, that when you put a black hole into anti-de Sitter space, into asymptotically anti-de Sitter space, if the magnitude of the cosmological constant is large enough, then it stabilizes the black hole. Okay, so now let's make it more interesting and make the thing rotate. This is the line element for the ADS Kerr metric. So you have a rotating black hole, which is asymptotically ADS. For those of you who are familiar with Kerr metric, you'll recognize all this stuff pretty quickly. For those of you who are not familiar, you're probably not going to get much out of this slide. But
What I want to emphasize here is that there are three parameters in this geometry. There's little m, which you might want to think of as the analog of the mass of the black hole. There's capital L, which is just a rewriting of the cosmological constant here. And then this parameter little a, which is essentially describing the rotation of the black hole. Little a actually turns out to be the specific angular momentum. It'll turn out to be the angular momentum per unit mass of the black hole. So don't be fazed by the formula here. All I want you to take away from this slide is that geometrically there are three parameters in this metric, little m, capital L, and little a. Then we can work out the mass. It's actually non-trivial. This is an analog of ADM mass for asymptotically anti-de-Sitter space. And there are various ways of calculating it. For example, you can add boundary terms at spatial infinity. You can add the extrinsic curvature of the boundary and just the volume element of the boundary and with two free parameters, and then adjust those parameters so the Euclidean action is finite as the boundary goes out to infinity. So that's one way. That allows you to calculate z, and then the Gibbs free energy is minus t log z, and everything works out. The rotation affects the area of the event horizon. The area of the event horizon goes up when the thing rotates. The angular momentum turns out to be little a times the ADM mass. So this is why I say that little a is a specific angular momentum. The angular velocity can be written in terms of the geometrical variables like this. And the pressure, of course, is trivially related to the cosmological constant through this factor of 1 over 8 pi. And the temperature works out like this. But again, I don't expect you to memorize these formula. All I want you to take away from this transparency is that the three geometric parameters, little m, capital L, and little a, have been traded for three thermodynamic parameters, the entropy, the pressure, and the angular momentum. And these are the parameters we'll use, because then we can write down the mass as a function of entropy, pressure, and angular momentum. And this is what it looks like. This is the ADM mass. This particular formula, I think, was first written down by Caldarelli and company in 99. But I discovered talking to Raphael yesterday that it's actually a slight generalization of a formula he wrote. I'm going to keep doing that, excuse me. A formula Raphael wrote down in 1982, where the pressure was zero. Raphael wrote down the mass of a Kerr black hole in asymptotically flat space in terms of entropy and angular momentum. And he also included a charge, actually. This can be generalized to charge, which I'll say more about later. So the temperature, you work it out differentiating the enthalpy. And when you convert this back to the geometric variables, this is, of course, the right answer. It had to be. This is just a trivial rewriting of the usual expression. Demanding the temperature is positive means that there's a maximum angular momentum, of course. So this is maximum angular momentum is the extremal case of zero temperature. So we work out the thermodynamic volume, derivative of enthalpy with respect to pressure. And it looks like this. This is first done by David and collaborators. David did higher dimensions as well. I'm focusing here on 3+1. In terms of geometrical variables, this is what the volume looks like. Doesn't tell you much. But one of the things that Zivedic et al. Pointed out in this paper was that if we define a sort of naive geometric volume, V naught, as just being you multiply the area by the radius and divide by 3. I mean, that's what you do in flat Euclidean space. That would be the relation between the volume and the area in flat Euclidean space. Then the thermodynamic volume, V, is always bigger than V naught. You can write it like this in terms of J squared over M. But what this means is that the ratio of the area to the volume for a black hole, a rotating black hole, is always bigger than the ratio of the area to the volume for a non-rotating black hole. And that's the opposite of your three-dimensional Euclidean intuition. Your three-dimensional Euclidean intuition tells you that the smallest area to volume ratio is a perfect sphere. And if you distort the surface away from a perfect sphere, the area to volume will always be greater than that of a perfect sphere. This is saying that if you a non-rotating black hole is perfectly symmetric. If you rotate it, you're distorting it away from a perfect sphere, and you find that the ratio of the area to the volume always goes up So this, David and his collaborators call this the reverse isoperimetric inequality. Because the theorem that a sphere is a shape with the smallest surface to volume ratio is called the isoperimetric inequality. Another way of writing this is to say that if we multiply the volume by 3 over 4 pi and take the cube root, so in Euclidean geometry that would just be the radius of the sphere, and compare that to a quarter of the area over pi, and the square root of that, which in Euclidean geometry that would also be the radius of the sphere. So in Euclidean geometry, these two quantities would be equal. But if the black hole rotates, the volume, the thing you get from the volume becomes greater than the thing you would get from the area. So it's the first thing you learn from introducing rotation is that actually rotation is very important, because if the thing is not rotating, then the volume and the entropy are not independent. Now, in thermodynamics, the internal energy is a function of entropy and volume. And entropy and volume should be independent thermodynamic parameters. If they're not independent, then there's something singular about the thermodynamics. So when the black hole is not rotating, then your thermodynamic functions are not well behaved. It's only, you've got to rotate it. When you rotate it, the volume and the entropy actually become independent. When it's not rotating, they're fixed related to each other. So the suggestion is that this is how you should write the first law for black hole thermodynamics. I've included now an electric charge with electrostatic potential phi. In all of the textbooks you see, I mean, if you look up standard textbooks on general relativity, the PdV term is not there. Most people would say the first law of black hole thermodynamics is dU is TdS plus omega dJ plus phi dQ. And what I'm suggesting here is that should be modified to include this minus PdV term. A formula like this is not new. As I said, back in the early 80s, Hennau and Teitelbaum suggested that the cosmological constant should be considered as a thermodynamic variable. And many people have rediscovered this idea. This particular formula, where the thermodynamic variable conjugate to the cosmological constant is called capital theta. This capital theta seems to become a standard notation in the literature for the thermodynamic variable conjugate to the cosmological constant. So this particular formula actually appears in Caldarelli et al.'s 1999 paper. So all I'm doing here is mathematically, it's completely trivial. It's just a slight change in notation. I'm calling lambda p, essentially, and I'm calling theta v. But the physical interpretation is now completely different. As far as I'm aware, no one had ever given this capital theta a physical interpretation before. I'm suggesting it's a volume, and you should really take it seriously as being a volume associated with the thermodynamics of the black hole. One argument, and this is given in Kasser et al.'s paper, of why it's sensible to think of the cosmological constant as a thermodynamic variable is what's called the Smar relation. In ordinary thermodynamics, the internal energy is a function of entropy, volume, and the number of moles, three extensive variables. So the entropy is proportional to the volume of your system. So in d dimensions, the entropy, if you rescale lengths by a factor lambda, the entropy scales as lambda to the power d. The volume obviously scales as lambda to the power d. And the number of moles will scale as lambda to the power d. And the internal energy is also extensive, so it scales as lambda to the power d. So you scale everything, just increases the size of your system. You increase all length scales by a factor of lambda. You get this equation here, which I think is called Euler's equation. If you differentiate with respect to lambda and set lambda equal to 1, you get this relation relating for this partial differential equation for u. But of course, du by ds is the temperature, du by dv is minus the pressure, and du by dn is the chemical potential. So u can be written like this. And then you wrong the transform to get the Gibbs free energy. And what you find is that in ordinary thermodynamics, the Gibbs free energy is just the number of moles times the chemical potential. This is called the Gibbs-Duhem relation. It's simple dimensional analysis. Nothing more to it than that. If you do the same thing for a black hole, entropy, has dimensions of area, pressure, when you put Newton's constant equal to one, pressure has dimensions of one over an area. Angular momentum has dimensions of area. And the mass, of course, just like the Schwarzschild radius, has dimensions of length. So if we rescale everything by lambda, we get this equation here. Differentiate with respect to lambda, put lambda equal to 1. We get a differential equation for h. And this is the Smar relation for black hole thermodynamics. It has simple generalizations to other dimensions. But the important point, the thing that Castoray and Trashin pointed out, is if you miss this VP term out, you get the wrong answer. It doesn't work. The Smar relation does not work unless you include the cosmological constant as a thermodynamic parameter. So that was their motivation for introducing this in the first instance, and then they were automatically led to consider the mass to be the enthalpy rather than the internal energy. So this is now the first law. If we now consider a mechanical process, and this is a thermodynamic way of viewing a Penrose process, then the mechanical energy we could get out of a black hole by performing irreversible processes is minus the du. And Penrose showed, didn't put up the reference here, I think it was 1969, Penrose showed that it is actually possible to extract energy from a black hole if it's rotating. I think it came as a bit of a surprise to people at the time, because when you first hear about black holes, you tend to think of a black hole as being this, having this voracious appetite. You have this massive object that's sucking everything into it, and the mass goes up and nothing ever comes out. But Penrose realized that actually there are reversible processes which allow you to decrease the mass of a black hole. The thing that always goes up is the area, not the mass. This was part of the entropy story. So if a black hole is rotating, the kinetic energy of rotation contributes to the mass. So if you torque it and slow it up, then the mass can go down and you can extract energy. That's a Penrose process. So when we include the PdV term, that changes the efficiency of a Penrose process, because it changes the mechanical energy. Obviously, because the entropy cannot go down, the most efficient process you can have is an adiabatic process where dS is 0. So if we put dS is equal to 0, and for simplicity, I'll just consider the 0 charge for the moment, then the maximum work you can get out of a black hole is if you start from an extremal black hole with a maximum angular momentum and then torque it so the angular momentum goes down to 0. And in particular, if you fix the pressure so that the only variable you have in here is, the only thing you can change in here is the angular momentum, and you decrease the angular momentum, so dJ is negative, then you're getting positive mechanical energy out of your system. And when you include this PdV term, it turns out the maximum efficiency you can get is slightly less than 52%. Now compare that to what you'll find in the textbooks when the PdV term is omitted and you get Penrose's original answer, which is 29%. So what's happening here is that you're getting, it's actually, it's an interesting story, because there's a tension between the PdV term and the omega dJ term. If you fix the pressure and lower the angular momentum, then omega dJ is giving a positive contribution to the work. But as you lower the angular momentum, you reduce the thermodynamic volume. So the PdV term is actually negative. So there's a tension between minus omega dJ and PdV, and you'd think that the PdV term ought to reduce the efficiency. But what actually happens is that when the cosmological constant is negative, the maximum angular momentum is greater than it is in the asymptotically flat case. So although for any infinitesimal step, the PdV term makes the process less efficient, you can make it go for longer because you've got more angular momentum to change. And the final result is that the efficiency with a negative cosmological constant can, in principle, be greater than an asymptotically flat space, because there's more angular momentum to be got. When you include a charge, you get even greater efficiencies. The asymptotically flat case.
I think what you just told me is that the blue Wald's answer or Penrose's answer is the right answer when p equals 0.
Yes. Yes.
But you're saying that other red answer is the answer for any value
Oh, no, no, you have to choose the optimal value of P as well. Well, strictly speaking, it's, yeah, it's, there's an optimal value of P times S. P times S is dimensionless, and pressure times entropy is dimensionless. There's an optimal value of P times S that gives you 51.8%. You have to solve a quartic equation in order to get the extremal efficiency. And the explicit answer is not very useful, obviously. But so I didn't actually put it down here, but I should have. There's a particular value of P times S that gives you this optimal value.
But in general, there's going to be a formula then,
yes.
A function that
yes. Interpolated. Yeah. I didn't write it down because. Yeah.
So the answer to this question is probably no, but I'll ask it anyway. Since there's an optimal value of P times S, could you imagine somehow not keeping P and S constant, but sort of keeping the product constant?
Well, if the product is fixed, then this is the efficiency you get. If you fix the product at the value that gives the maximum efficiency, then this is the maximum efficiency you get. You could do more complicated things and start varying P as well as you could fix S and go through some thermodynamic process where you vary P as well as J, and then there's a more complicated story. I'm not sure what the answer is then.
So it might even be higher.
I suppose possibly yes. Yeah, but I can't answer that definitively. But the point is that this is calculated as specific P times S, so putting P to zero gives you a different answer. Okay. Another thing we can ask is, when you start looking at things this way is, what's the compressibility of the black hole? We have a function for an expression for the volume. So we can define an adiabatic compressibility in the usual thermodynamic way, as being how the volume varies as you vary the pressure, keeping the entropy and the angular momentum fixed. And again, for zero angular momentum, because there's a fixed relationship between the volume and the entropy when the angular momentum is zero, then if you put the angular momentum to zero and then demand that the entropy is fixed, the volume can't change. So the compressibility is necessarily zero for a non-rotating black hole. That's completely incompressible. However, when you allow it to rotate, it becomes a bit floppier. And in fact, the maximum adiabatic compressibility occurs for an extremal black hole, again, where the angular momentum takes its maximum value, so the temperature is zero. And this is the formula for the maximum adiabatic compressibility. And there's nothing to stop you taking the P goes to zero limit in this case. And when you do that, so this is in an asymptotically flat black hole, the compressibility becomes 2 over 9 times the entropy. The entropy is for a Schwarzschild black hole. Well, sorry, this is an extremal black hole. So you can relate the entropy to the mass of an extremal black hole. Again, it goes like m squared. And you can work this out in terms of ordinary units, and you get the answer of a few times 10 to the minus 38. In units, so it's the square of it goes like the square of the mass of the black hole. So in solar mass units, it's about 10 to the minus 38 times the mass of the black hole divided by the mass of the sun squared. And we can compare this, just for fun, to the compressibility of a neutron star. Just assuming a degenerate Fermi gas equation of state for the neutron star, it's trivial to work out the compressibility. And for a solar mass neutron star, the compressibility is about 10 to minus 34. So our black hole equation of state, even for the floppiest black hole you can have, which is the maximally rotating one, the compressibility is still four orders of magnitude less than the compressibility of a neutron star. So it's actually highly incompressible. You know, the compressibility, it's not completely incompressible, but it's a very low compressibility. And when you have these formula, it's absolutely irresistible to work out a density and define a speed of sound. This is the usual thermodynamic expression for speed of sound due to adiabatic compression. And I've put it in quotes here because
this velocity doesn't have all of the, that we can calculate here, doesn't have all the properties that you'd expect of sound. So maybe it's not really fair to call it the speed of sound. But in analogy with ordinary thermodynamics, that's what you would call it. You work it out, and it actually falls out as really a rather a simple formula in terms of angular momentum and entropy. The 1 over the square of the speed of sound is always bigger than 1. Well, that's good news. If you really want to think of this as being a velocity, it means the velocity is always less than 1. And the maximum value that 1 over Vs squared can have is when j goes to infinity, when it's 2. So the speed of sound lies between a half, or the square of the speed of sound lies between a half and 1, if you want to call this the speed of sound. But I don't know, I've put speed of sound in quotes because, I mean, sound normally transports energy from one place to another, and there's no notion of energy being transported around from this. It's more really, you fix the area of the black hole, and the volume is not the same as the area. The volume can change. So the volume can fluctuate, and the area is fixed. So there's oscillations associated with the, this is the thermodynamic volume, and I'm waving my hands here as though it's geometric. But I don't really know how to visualize it. This is not a geometric volume. But the volume is oscillating while the entropy is fixed. And the frequency of those oscillations is associated with this speed. But there's no transport of energy from one place to another. So maybe it's not really fair to call that a speed of sound. I don't know. But when you look at black holes in this language, it's impossible to avoid the temptation to calculate this object. And again, I have absolutely no idea why it always turns out to be less than 1. It just seems to be some kind of coincidence. Or maybe there's some deeper reason for it. I don't know. OK. Now, let's get on to the critical behavior, because it has been known for some time that these rotating Kerr ADS black holes have critical points. If we plot the specific heat, what I'm plotting here is I'm using P to make the pressure to make things dimensionless. So this is the angular momentum. The vertical axis is angular momentum times the pressure. That's a dimensionless number. And the horizontal axis is the entropy times the pressure. Again, a dimensionless number. The green curve is extremal angular momentum. So above and to the left of the green curve, the temperature is negative. So we're not interested in that region. It has no physical significance. Below and to the right of the green curve, the temperature is positive. So that's good. The red curve is the locus of points on which the specific heat at constant pressure diverges. So the black hole is unstable below the red curve, locally unstable below the red curve, unstable above it. So we see that if we're below the top of the red curve here, for a given angular momentum, there are 2 entropies at which this thing diverges. Right? And the entropy is proportional to the area of the black hole. So there are 2 black holes, a large black hole and a small black hole. But as you increase the angular momentum, the difference between these 2 areas gets less and less until they merge at this point here. Here there's only 1. And then above that, everything is stable. So this is like a second order phase transition. So there's 2 different phases here, a large black hole and a small black hole, and they merge to a single phase at this critical point. And again, this was pointed out, as far as I know, first in this paper by Calderelli et al. And they calculated some of the values of the thermodynamic parameter at this critical point. They weren't considering the pressure as being a thermodynamic variable. They just had this length scale L in the anti de Sitter metric, and they just put L is equal to 1. And these are modulo factors of pi and stuff that I've introduced, and these are the same numbers. So these are the coordinates of the top of this red curve, the critical area and the critical angular momentum. You can see the nature of this second order critical point by plotting the Gibbs free energy as a function of temperature, pressure, and angular momentum. And when you do it, you get this shape here. And this relates to work that Rob did that I'll come on to in a minute for charged black holes, where there's also a critical point. The point is that the equation of state is actually essentially, it's in the same class as the van der Waals equation of state. And it's been known for a long time
But if you plot the Gibbs free energy for the van der Waals equation of state, the analytic structure is essentially the same as what people in catastrophe theory call a swallowtail catastrophe. I don't actually understand that language myself. It's clear that this is not a swallow, it's a kestrel. Anyone who knows anything about birds would say that's a kestrel. There's also, as far as I'm aware, nothing particularly catastrophic about boiling a kettle. although, in order to see this structure, you'd have to boil your kettle 2,000 meters below the surface of the ocean, but there's nothing particularly catastrophic about it. But anyway, this is called a swallowtail catastrophe. And it's well known that this is standard, a standard structure for the van der Waals gas, the critical point for van der Waals gas. So we can get a better idea of what's happening by examining the critical point in a bit more detail. Here, I've worked out the critical temperature and the critical volume. So everything here is being measured in units of J. I've decided to use J as my dimensional parameter for the units. So we define little t, little v, and little p as being the dimensionless deviation away from the critical point. And we can expand the equation of state around the critical point. And it looks like this. These numbers are analytically calculable. You have to solve a quartic equation, but the actual explicit form is messy and not very illuminating, so I've just written them in there numerically. This is not the full equation of state. There are corrections if the deviation from the critical point gets large. But the important part of the analytic structure is the first three terms here. This is what people in catastrophe theory would call this the germ for the singular point. And below that, I've written the equation of state for the van der Waals gas. And what we notice is that the numbers are different, but what's important is that it's the same type of terms and the signs. The numbers don't change signs. If they change signs, then the nature of the critical point would change. So we can work out critical exponents. It's standard stuff for the van der Waals gas. We have the specific heat at constant volume is defined to the reverse like t to the minus alpha. So alpha is the critical exponent associated with specific heat. But although I haven't told you this yet, the specific heat at constant pressure diverges, but the specific heat at constant volume is always finite. It's easy enough to work it out. It's well known, it's been well known for a long time, that the specific heat at constant volume is finite for a van der Waals gas. It is also finite for these black holes. So that means that alpha is zero. Alpha being zero doesn't imply the specific heat at constant volume is finite. You could have a logarithmic divergence. But for the van der Waals gas, it actually is finite. And that always implies that alpha is zero. If you fix the pressure, so little p is slightly negative, so you're just below the critical point, then when a liquid boils, you go from the volume of the liquid to the volume of the gas, the discrete jump. So for the van der Waals equation in the liquid gas phase transition, you can use the volume as your order parameter and ask how that order parameter varies with temperature. At the critical point, there's no difference between, so this is V greater here is the volume of the larger black hole, and this is the volume of the smaller black hole. And as you approach the critical point, these two volumes become the same. But if you're slightly away from it, they go like a power of t. And for the van der Waals gas, that power is a half. The isothermal compressibility, the adiabatic compressibility is finite. The isothermal compressibility, and I notice I've changed the notation here. I use beta for the adiabatic compressibility. I'm now using kappa for the isothermal compressibility. The isothermal compressibility does diverge. It diverges along the same curve as the specific heat to constant pressure diverges on. And if you work out the analytic structure for this exponent gamma, it's 1. And for the pressure, if you put little t equal to 0, the pressure goes like the cube of the volume. You can see that immediately from the equation of state here. If you put little t to 0, the pressure is going like the cube of the volume. So this is the standard. Delta is the standard notation of that critical exponent. These are mean field exponents, the same as for the van der Waals gas. And these mean field exponents have shown up in black hole thermodynamics before. All of this structure, this critical point structure, has been in the literature from a different perspective. And I think there are three people in the audience, or maybe more, I don't know all of the authors here. There are at least three people in the audience who have contributed to this. If the angular momentum is zero and the black hole has an electric charge, then Rob and co-workers pointed out a long time ago that this swallowtail structure crops up in the Gibbs free energy. You get this van der Waals type behavior where the angular momentum, instead of angular momentum, you talk about the electric charge. And David and Rob recently explicitly worked out the analytic expansion of the equation of state for an electric charge with angular momentum zero. And again, we get these three terms, T minus TV minus V cubed, plus higher order terms. And again, these coefficients have changed, but again, the signs are the same. So you get the same structure as van der Waals. So, and again, so you get the mean field critical exponents, and the Gibbs free energy will have this swallowtail type structure. So more generally, what's going on here is, again, I refer to the same paper here by Cordarelli, where they did a very detailed analysis of the stability of charged rotating black holes in asymptotically anti-de-Sitter space. And what they pointed out was that when you include the charge, I won't put the formula in because they're probably not very informative, but you can do it. What happens is that when Q is zero and J is non-zero, you have a critical point here. That's what I spent most of this, the last few transparencies talking about. But you can also put J to zero and have an electric charge. And again, you get a critical point. That's what people here did. But Calderelli et al. Showed that, in fact, there's a whole line of second-order phase transitions in the J2 plane that look like this. And this is a good point to point out that for those of you who know that the critical point I'm talking about here is not the Hawking-Page phase transition. The Hawking-Page phase transition is when the black hole is a first order phase transition where the black hole is unstable to just decaying to pure anti-de-Sitter. But in this, what I'm doing here is I'm fixing the charge and fixing the angular momentum. And if you do that, if you fix the charge at something non-zero, then clearly the black hole can't just decay to anti-de-Sitter because of conservation of charge. And similarly, if you fix the angular momentum, the black hole can't decay to anti-de-Sitter. So in thermodynamic language, this is the canonical ensemble where you're fixing the charge or fixing the angular momentum. If you use the grand canonical ensemble where you coupled your system to an infinite bath of charges and allowed charges to come in and out and just fix the chemical potential, then the black hole could decay to pure ADS. So in the grand canonical ensemble, you can have the Hawking-Page phase transition. But in the canonical ensemble, you can't. And that was pointed out by these guys. OK, well, maybe I'm a few minutes short. But since some people have to go, that's perhaps not a bad thing. So just to summarize what I've said, the suggestion is that when the cosmological constant is non, when you, the cosmological constant should be included as a thermodynamic variable in the laws of black hole thermodynamics. And when you do that, the black hole mass should be identified with the chemist's enthalpy, not with the usual internal energy, which I think is what most people would have thought of up until now. The Hawking temperature just follows naturally. The suggestion is that we define the derivative of the black hole mass with respect to the pressure when the appropriate variables are kept constant, as being a thermodynamic volume. And when for rotating black holes, the resulting volume is not independent of the entropy, so it's perhaps not very interesting. Sorry, for non-rotating black holes. But when the black hole rotates, the thermodynamic volume and the entropy become independent variables. And you really can think of this volume as being a thermodynamic variable, and there's no inconsistencies. The Euclidean action gives you a partition function. Z is the exponential of minus the Euclidean action. And then that relates to the Gibbs free energy rather than Helmholtz free energy. And we have this line of second order critical points in the JQ plane. So some questions, just a very short list of questions that immediately present themselves. And I'm sure many people can think of more. So there are now two different heat capacities, the heat capacity at constant pressure and the heat capacity at constant volume. The heat capacity that people usually talk about in black hole thermodynamics is the heat capacity at constant pressure. Is there some physical role for the heat capacity at constant volume? Well, probably not in astrophysics, but in ADS-CFT correspondence approach to condensed matter applications, perhaps the specific heat constant volume might have some role to play. What is the role of angular momentum here? And this is implying some kind of curious relation between angular momentum and charge, which I don't really understand. Perhaps one observation would be that as far as the gravitational field is concerned, as far as the background gravitational field is concerned, the black hole cannot tell the difference between an electric charge and a magnetic charge. They both are fields that fall off like 1 over r squared. The energy momentum tensor looks the same. So this Q could be a magnetic charge, and everything would be just the same. And it seems, it seems much more natural to me to have a relation between angular momentum and magnetic charge than to have a relation between angular momentum and electric charge. But there's nothing in the formalism that's telling you this is a magnetic charge and not an electric charge. So. I think, very interesting questions are, what happens if positive coupling is a constant? I mean, clearly, in any kind of astrophysical interpretation, you want to go to positive lambda. But the thermodynamics of De Sitter space is not understood, certainly not by me. Perhaps other people understand it better, but it's a bit of a mystery. I mean, when the cosmological constant is positive, there are two event horizons. You have a black hole event horizon and a cosmological event horizon. Naive applications of Hawking formula gives you two different temperatures, so it's not in thermal equilibrium. It's unclear what to do. Though, at the most naive level, a positive cosmological constant, of course, means negative pressure, and negative pressures are unstable. The negative pressure itself is not necessarily a problem. I mean, you can have unstable thermodynamic systems and still learn things about them. I mean, after all, Hawking's original discovery of Hawking radiation in asymptotically flat space is unstable, but the timescale for decay is so much greater than the age of the universe for large mass black holes, you can still discuss it in thermodynamic terms. So there's nothing, there's a number of situations, it's often possible in physics to consider systems with negative pressure using thermodynamics. It's not a crazy thing to do. It's routinely done in fluid dynamics to discuss cavitation, for example. And cosmologically, we know the universe is a negative pressure. So regardless of what misgivings you might have from a theoretical point of view, you have to face up to the fact that we should be considering equations of state with negative pressure in a cosmological context. And another question would be, can we go beyond mean field? What is all of the systems that I've shown here give mean field exponents? And in condensed matter systems, in the Landau-Ginzburg approach to the paramagnetic ferromagnetic phase transition, for example, mean field means that you're ignoring the kinetic term. You get mean field purely from the potential term in the Landau-Ginzburg action. It's just a polynomial. You just analyze the critical points of that polynomial, and you get mean field exponents. The way to get away from mean field exponents in condensed matter systems is to introduce a kinetic term and consider propagation. But what that would mean in a black hole context, I don't know. Presumably, or perhaps, something to do with quantum gravity. But I don't have anything more to say about that. So these are a few questions that the formalism raises. And I'm sure other people can think of more. So thank you. Yeah, Rob.
Last one. Do you have any speculations on what would happen with black holes that have enough charge? Although they have some peculiar properties, it does seem possible to construct the thermodynamics for them.
Okay.
And I don't know, it's not clear to me if they'll still obey the usual Van der Waals thing or not.
Yeah, I don't know. I've certainly never thought about it. the answer to the question is no. I don't have any speculation. So, an interesting question, but I don't have any light to shed on it.
Okay. Nothing else to think of.